Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is a perfect storm of conspiracy theories.
On December 15th, 2017, Canadian billionaires Honey and Barry Sherman were found dead in their mansion. To this day, the case remains unsolved.
Counterfeit and copied pharmaceuticals was much more lucrative than heroin, cocaine and the rest of it.
If you live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Listen to the no good, terribly kind, wonderful lives and tragic deaths of Barry and Honey Sherman, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 22nd of February, these are our main stories. A year after its invasion, President Biden says Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia in a defiant speech in Poland, just hours after President Putin lashed out at the West during an address in Russia. A court in New York finds Mexico's former anti-narcotics chief guilty of pocketing millions in return for allowing safe passage for drugs. And parts of southern Africa on high alert as a powerful cyclone hits Madagascar. Also in this podcast, why some of the canals of Venice are completely dry, and how do you get artificial intelligence to write you a novel in a matter of hours?
You start giving the ChatGPT information about characters and settings that you want your book to revolve around.
Autocrats only understand one word, no. They were the words of President Joe Biden as he challenged Vladimir Putin's vision of the war in Ukraine. Standing outside the royal castle in the Polish capital, Warsaw, he urged the world's democracies to continue standing up to Russian aggression.
No, you will not take my freedom. No, you will not take my future. A dictator bent on rebuilding an empire will never be able to ease the people's love of liberty. Brutality will never grind down the will of the free. And Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia. Never.
When Russian tanks rolled into Ukraine on the 24th of February last year, neighbouring Poland opened its border to millions of Ukrainians fleeing their country, and Polish people welcomed refugees into their homes. Joe Biden's speech came after that of his Polish counterpart, Andrzej Duda, who addressed the crowd through an interpreter.
This is the role of NATO, to defend the free world, to support the free world. We stand in solidarity with Ukraine, and we will stand in solidarity with Ukraine. There is no freedom without solidarity. Long live free Ukraine. Long live the alliance of the Republic of Poland with the United States. Long live NATO. Long live free world. Long live Poland.
A correspondent in Warsaw, Adam Easton, told me what it felt like to hear President Biden's speech.
It was a very rousing speech. The emotion in the crowd was palpable. There was lots of cheering and applause, even though the actual content of President Biden's speech wasn't a great deal different from the one he made in almost exactly the same place 11 months ago. But he did speak to several different audiences. He reassured Ukrainians that US support was unwavering. He spoke to his hosts, the Poles, and thanked them, and also told them that the US commitment to NATO is rock solid. So that's very important for people in Poland and the region. And he spoke to Putin, telling him he would fail. And last but not least, he spoke to ordinary Russians, saying that they were not the enemy.
Sounded very defiant, I thought, in tone, perhaps more so than usual. What sort of reaction has he got among Polish people?
His speech and his visit in general, I think, has been very much welcomed and appreciated here in Poland. This visit is unprecedented. It's two visits to Warsaw from President Biden in less than a year, fills many Poles with pride and the sense, as one Polish deputy foreign minister said today, that now the voices of the Central and Eastern European countries are being taken seriously at last. And maybe, even if it is only temporary, there's been a small shift in Europe from west to east in terms of influence.
Adam Easton with me from Poland. Vladimir Putin set the tone earlier on Tuesday during his State of the Nation address in Moscow. He accused Western elites of starting the war to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. President Putin also widened the divide between Russia and the US by announcing the suspension of the last remaining nuclear arms agreement between the two countries. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg was following the address in Moscow.
For Vladimir Putin, the invasion of Ukraine has not gone at all according to plan. But remorse? Regret? There's no hint of that. At an exhibition hall by the Kremlin, President Putin took the stage and took aim at the West. He repeated the Kremlin's false narrative that Western nations are responsible for the war in Ukraine. They started it, he said. Russia's using force to finish it. There is no sign that Mr. Putin is looking for an off-ramp. Russia suspends its participation in the New START treaty, he announced. New START is the last remaining nuclear arms control treaty between Russia and America. It limits nuclear arsenals and enables on-site inspections of strategic nuclear weapons. Andrei Kolesnikov of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace believes it's a dangerous move by Mr. Putin.
In order to avoid nuclear war, it's better to have a framework. But losing this framework, we are witnessing the real threat of a nuclear war.
But in the hall, Russian parliamentarians and officials were more than happy with what they heard. Supportive of a president who favours confrontation over compromise.
China's top diplomat Wang Yi is visiting Russia, where he said that relations between the two countries were rock solid and would withstand any challenges presented by a changing international situation. In Beijing, there's concern the war could spiral out of control. The Chinese president, Xi Jinping, is expected to make a speech later this week calling for peace in Ukraine. Our correspondent in Beijing is Stephen McDonnell.
The war on the ground may be between Ukraine and Russia, but in China, the war of words is between Beijing and Washington. The Chinese government has consistently blamed the US and its NATO allies for the ongoing conflict. When the flagship television news bulletin here covers the war, the state-controlled outlet routinely says the United States is manipulating events in Ukraine. It never speaks about an invasion and doesn't even call this a war. However, in Beijing today, China's Foreign Minister Qin Gang did predict, rather ominously, that the situation could become much worse. He didn't mention the US, but it was pretty clear who he was talking about. Researchers in America have already accused Xi Jinping's administration of supplying the Russian military with dual-use equipment, like fighter jet parts and jamming technology. The Chinese government has argued that it's neutral, but it's unclear what it might do to prevent a humiliating defeat for Vladimir Putin on the battlefield.
As the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine approaches, leaders on both sides of the conflict appear further apart than ever. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in Kyiv and assesses the potential impact inside Ukraine and beyond.
A year ago, President Zelensky warned a war in Ukraine would not stay in Ukraine. Today's rival narratives from Moscow, Warsaw, and Beijing have emphasized this yet again. They've also highlighted the continuing concern about an ever more dangerous escalation. President Putin's decision to step away from a nuclear arms control treaty has removed a key pillar in the world's vital security architecture. And today's belligerent tones underline how the divide between world powers grows ever deeper, with both sides now bent on achieving victory, ideally this year. Although here in Ukraine, this still seems like a war without end. The many other countries around the world suffering the consequences of this conflict are watching with alarm. President Biden's comment that this war will define the lives of generations to come underlines how this confrontation in Ukraine will have far-reaching and lasting consequences. And only 1 year into this war, that wider impact is still hard to foresee.
Lise Doucette in Kyiv. Genaro Garcia Luna was meant to be fighting Mexico's war on drugs, but the former security chief now faces 10 years to life in prison after taking bribes worth millions of dollars from a drugs cartel. He was found guilty by a court in New York. Our correspondent there is Neda Torfik.
This case really rested on the testimony of cartel members who have been convicted of their own drug crimes. And those members gave evidence about the bribes that Garcia Luna received, saying how it was all delivered in cash, once left in a safe house in a false wall, one time at a car wash in Guadalajara, another time at a French restaurant in Mexico City across from the U.S. Embassy. And they detailed just how essential Garcia Luna's involvement was to the cartel, passing along sensitive information about law enforcement investigations. At one point, one cartel member detailed how they were given federal police force escorts as bodyguards and police uniforms and badges to be able to load shipments of cocaine. And prosecutors really say that the Sinaloa cartel became this global cocaine empire and the biggest crime group in Mexico, specifically because of Garcia Luna's help.
How was he caught?
He was living in the United States, and in fact, there had been rumors about his complicity with the cartels. Prosecutors in the United States, I should say, initially decided not to go after him, thinking they didn't have enough evidence. But after the El Chapo trial in New York, he is the former kingpin of the Sinaloa cartel. After one of the witnesses, Jesus Zambada, said that he had given millions in cash bribes to Mr. Garcia Luna, well, then he was arrested in 2019 in Texas.
And are there more officials like Genaro Garcia Luna who may come to court yet?
Well, look, I think if you speak to many people in Mexico, you know, as I have in preparation for this trial, you know, many will say that there is always, this fear that the Sinaloa cartel and cartels like them can't operate without corrupt officials helping them. I will say that the United States, while they thought this might be the start of not just going after cartel members, but also corrupt politicians, well, Salvatore Cienfuegos, he was the former Mexican defense secretary who faced very similar charges to this in late 2020. After they arrested him, Mexico got very upset about that. They didn't take too kindly to another official being arrested in the United States. And ultimately, the United States did drop that case. But I think this also does send a signal to other officials that if they want to step foot in the United States and work with the United States, there is a bit of caution that needs to be taken.
Neda Torfik with me from New York. Let's stay in the US. The Supreme Court is considering a case which could have big implications for social media giants. Before them, an appeal by the family of an American student who died in an Islamist attack in Paris. They argue that YouTube, through its algorithms, unlawfully recommended the Islamic State Group videos to users, hence spreading its message. I heard more from our correspondent in Washington, Nomia Iqbal.
This involves 23-year-old Naomi Gonzalez. She was sat in a bistro in Paris when she died in a hail of bullets that were fired by Islamist militants. It was part of a rampage of attacks and suicide bombings that killed 130 people, and the Islamic State group claimed responsibility. And as you mentioned, at the heart of the family's case is their claim that YouTube, via its computer algorithms, unlawfully recommended videos to certain users by the terrorist group, and they want YouTube's owners, Google, to take responsibility. So they've taken it to the Supreme Court. Today we heard oral arguments about it. The key thing to know here is since 1996, online platforms have been protected by a specific section of the Communications Decency Act. And what big tech lobbyists are saying, what Google is saying, that if this is weakened, social media and online marketplaces could be open to costly litigation, which could then lead to tight censorship of who is allowed to post online.
In other words, the social media giants would be responsible for publishing the words that other people post on them. So maybe they would be forced to be much more vigilant to try and police all of that. But in the end, they're not responsible for what other people are saying on their platforms.
Exactly. I guess the bigger issue for certainly the Supreme Court justices who are discussing this today is the floodgates would open on lawsuits. So they're really worried about that. So Justice Elena Kagan said that this is something Congress should step in on. This isn't something the Supreme Court should be doing. She actually said, to quote her, the Supreme Court justices are not the nine greatest experts on the internet. The Chief Justice, John Roberts, he's worried that actually, where does the line end? Because if this section is weakened of this law, then people could claim all kinds of things. They could allege that they are distressed after watching a video, they are traumatised, there's defamation. It could just lead to all kinds of lawsuits being brought forward. And I think what they're really expressing scepticism on is if the Supreme Court should weigh in, because you then would have a wild, wild west atmosphere on the internet. And is the family really asking the Supreme Court to blame YouTube for the death of their daughter if they were to side with the terror victims? So this is what the Supreme Court is focusing on and worried about, but we won't know what their final judgment is until the summer.
Lomi Iqbal in Washington. The southeast coast of Madagascar is being lashed by high winds and heavy rain as Cyclone Freddy makes landfall on the Indian Ocean island nation. With gusts exceeding 120 kilometres an hour, meteorologists are warning it could cause considerable damage following an earlier tropical storm last month. Dorcas Wangira is in the capital, Antananarivo.
The authorities in Madagascar say that at least 2 million people will be affected and schools have been closed and movement restricted in the most affected areas. The National Disaster Management Office has sent tents, ropes, chainsaws and other supplies to those in the eastern districts most likely to be affected. The intense tropical storm has already caused heavy rains and some damage to the neighbouring islands of Reunion and Mauritius, where their airport was closed. The storm caused minor damage to neighbouring Reunion Island on Monday and flooded beachside hotels in Mauritius. Many businesses were also forced to close. In Madagascar, the island is not expected to get away so lightly. Emergency teams are preparing to deal with heavy rains, floods and even landslides in areas that will be affected. The island nation is among the top 10 African countries most exposed to cyclones and vulnerable to disasters. This is according to the World Food Programme. Those living in the areas have been advised to strengthen their doors and roofs, cut down dangerous trees, and stay indoors during the tropical storm. In the last few hours, I've received communication from international organizations operating in the coastal regions who now have limited communications and are laying low as the cyclone hits. We are unlikely to know the full story of its destruction until early morning on Wednesday. But this is a cause of a worrying time on the island.
Dorcas Wangira in Madagascar. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
I've been a terrible liar. I mean, would you be prepared to say that?
Sure. I've been a terrible liar on those subjects.
The US Congressman George Santos admits he's been economical with the truth. A court in Iran has sentenced a German-Iranian dual national to death, which Berlin has denounced as absolutely unacceptable. Iran accuses Jamshid Shahmad of being the leader of a pro-monarchist terrorist group. I've been talking to Baran Abbasi from BBC Persian.
His family say that he was abducted whilst on a trip in Dubai. He was in transit and he was travelling to India when he was arrested and taken to Iran. There he was faced charges of having planned and also leading some terrorist attacks inside of Iran, what the Iranian judiciary calls it, including an attack in the city of Shiraz in 2008. They say that he was the leader of a group called Tondar, which is the Persian word for thunder, also known as the Iran Monarchy Association. The Iranian regime say that this group is seeking to topple the Islamic Republic, and also they said that he was in contact with the FBI, CIA and the Israeli Mossad agents. All of them are, of course, charges that his family deny. They say that any confessions made by him were extracted under duress and that he had nothing to do with any of the attacks inside or outside of Iran.
Was the death penalty expected as the outcome to this case?
It was, because he was charged with corruption on earth through planning and directing a terrorist attack. This is a very vague charge, but it could carry the death penalty. Also, we've had cases in the past, people facing the same charges have been hanged. So it was expected. And also his family and some human rights organisations had warned that his life is in danger.
And is this a one-off, or do you expect to see more cases like this?
It seems to be happening over and over again, a practice called by Western governments as the practice of hostage-taking by Iranian officials. We've seen this in the past, the case of Ruhollah Zam, who was a journalist based in Paris in 2020. He was abducted whilst on a trip to Iraq. He was taken to Iran and then executed a few months after. So we've been seeing cases like this. Iranian, mostly dual nationals. There are more than a dozen Westerners in prison in Iran, and most of them are dual nationals.
Baron Abbasi from BBC Persian. Since being elected to Congress last year, George Santos has been accused of lying about everything from his religion, business life, schooling and family connections. And now he's admitted it in an interview with the British TV host Piers Morgan on his Piers Morgan Uncensored show on Talk TV. He said he hadn't been telling the truth.
I think that part of your cathartic process of redemption, if you like, it's got to start from I've been a terrible liar. I mean, would you be prepared to say that?
Sure. Like well, I said, well, I've been a terrible liar on, on those subjects.
David Lewis has been doing a reality check on George Santos for us.
It's certainly worth looking back over George Santos's inventory of make-believe, and there is a lot to unpack. On the campaign trail last year, the 34-year-old Republican said he was the grandson of Holocaust survivors, claimed to have been educated at the elite Baruch College in New York City before working with world-renowned banking firms Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. There's no evidence for any of these. He also claimed to own more than a dozen properties. Not true. He denied categorically he was ever a drag queen. He was. And all this matters. Up until now, the politician seemed hopeful he could bat away the many allegations against him. He ducked and dived, conceding he'd embellished sections of his CV and that he was not Jewish, but in fact Jew-ish. After admitting to being a terrible liar to Piers Morgan, Mr. Santos explained why he did what he did.
This wasn't about tricking anybody. This wasn't about it's.
Yes, he was.
No. Let me finish.
The whole thing was about tricking people.
Let me finish. It wasn't about tricking the people. This was about getting accepted by the party here locally.
He's subject to multiple congressional investigations while also facing an allegation of sexual misconduct from a former aide. If he chooses to stay put, it's not easy to evict a congressman, even one with such a complicated relationship with the truth. In short, there's no guarantees going anywhere.
David Lewis reporting. Now, the remains of what could be the world's oldest flushing toilet have been found in China. Let's get the story from Baldeep Chahal.
During excavations of ancient palace ruins in the central city of Xi'an in the summer, archaeologists unearthed broken parts of the old toilet as well as a bent flush pipe. In their report, researchers say it could be 2,400 years old. If true, that would make it the oldest flushing toilet ever found. But what they can't say is whether users sat on a seat or squatted over it, because the top part is missing. Prior to this discovery, the invention of the first flushing toilet was widely credited to English courtier John Harrington, who supposedly installed one for Queen Elizabeth in the 16th century. Though 4,000-year-old drainage systems that might have been connected with toilets have been found in northwest India. The recent find is part of a broader effort to understand ancient Chinese dynasties, including how people lived and how their cities were constructed. Archaeologists are now analysing soil samples collected from the toilet in the hope of finding out what people ate during that time.
Think of Venice and you think of stunning bridges, a warren of streets, the presence everywhere of canals. Right now, the picture in part at least isn't of waterways but trenches of wet mud. Gondolas are beached on banks, exposing the foundations of buildings. Jane DeMosto lives in Venice and runs the campaign group We Are Here Venice. She's been talking to Tim Franks.
It's really just on the smaller side canals. Even though it's super low tide level, there's water in the Grand Canal, there's water in St. Mark's Basin, there's water in the shipping lanes. So it really affects the side canals that are used by gondolas, delivery boats, and it reveals one of the critical issues to do with Venice today, which is the importance of regular maintenance. So when the water gets very low, we see just how far behind the administration has been in cleaning the canals. You know, a lot of stuff accumulates in the canals. People are irresponsible and they throw away things. The tourism creates a lot of rubbish. Water traffic produces vibrations that cause the sides of the canals, the brickwork, to crumble. So times like this are really important opportunities to get a snapshot of the state of Venice and its fragility.
I absolutely hear what you're saying. Indeed, it's been striking in some of the photos to see the exposed foundations or lower stories of buildings, and they don't look to be in great repair. When it comes, though, to the relative dearth of water, the lack of water in some of these smaller canals, what are we to draw from that? Is this a problem that Venice encounters every so often, or is it connected to what we're also hearing, which is that water levels elsewhere in Italy are dangerously low?
No, the low water level in the canals is linked to the astronomical tide, which is, you know, the same everywhere according to the pull of the moon, combined with high atmospheric pressure that causes sea level to be lower. When there's high atmospheric pressure, sea level is suppressed. So there are, in Venice, very significant issues to do with its survival in the face of climate change. But the low water level in the canal now is not to do with that.
And just in terms of what it means for life in Venice, again, I've seen pictures of gondolas stuck on these mud banks. Gondolas are presumably there to ferry tourists around. Does it interfere with daily life, though, in other ways?
I'm not actually sure if some of the routes, say, used by ambulance boats or the fire boats are affected by these ultra-low water levels, but I don't think so. I think it's really just the smaller, narrow canals, which are just used maybe by, as I said, by gondolas and the delivery boats, and maybe it might be inconvenience for some taxis to take tourists to their hotel. On my way home this evening, I saw some French people have to do quite a long jump to get out of their gondola onto the steps on the side of the canal. And somebody from the bridge was a friend of the gondoliere, and he shouted, "What are you going to do now?" And the gondoliere was very happy to say he was just going to quit for the day and go and have a glass of red wine.
Jane DeMosto with Tim Franks. One of France's last surviving female resistance fighters from the Second World War, Simone Seguin, has died at the age of 97. She was made famous when photographs of her carrying a machine pistol during the liberation of the town of Chartres were published in the American press. Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield reflects now on the life of a woman who is acclaimed as one of France's war heroes.
This brave and beautiful girl is a veteran of partisan fighting.
Born into a farming family near Chartres, Simone Seguin joined the French resistance in 1944, and when Chartres fell to the Allies in August of that year, she was there with the liberators. American war correspondents knew they had a good story when they saw this 18-year-old blonde in shorts and Schmeisser machine pistol bringing up the rear of a party of German prisoners. Her picture went round the world once, and then again when she took part a few days later in the liberation of Paris. Her role in the resistance was a minor one, and after the war she returned to obscurity, becoming a pediatric nurse. But her image became one of a handful that helped define the war in France and the heroic role of some of the French in bringing the occupation to an end.
The artificial intelligence software ChatGPT simplifies tasks that are normally time-consuming. Could it be working a bit too well, though, because there's now been an explosion of books being sold online which don't have human authors? Andrew Cheng told me exactly what ChatGPT does.
Well, it's basically a software that has been fed with so much information from all over the world, and it's been trained to assist with a variety of tasks. It was made by a company called OpenAI with a lot of support from Microsoft.
And in this case, a publisher is saying it won't accept submissions anymore because people are using it.
Yes, Claxworld, which is a monthly science fiction and fantasy magazine in the US, has said it will not be accepting any new material for now. Now, this is a popular magazine in its genre, and it's won many awards for its work, and is believed to be one of the best places for writers to submit short fiction because of reports of how quickly it responds and how well it pays. But they posted on social media that they simply cannot keep up. They say this month alone they've had to ban more than 500 submissions because they believed the material was either generated by machines entirely or partly, and that the number has been steadily increasing since December last year. Previously, the main problem was plagiarism, but this one is bigger and they don't have a solution for it. They're saying their detectors are not very reliable.
And who is doing this?
The magazine says the machine-generated books are being produced by side hustlers, people who are in it just to make an extra coin. We've seen, for example, reports of a salesman in New York who wrote a 30-page children's book with illustrations in just a few hours. It's selling for about $15 on eBay.
Now, I've had a play with this ChatGPT software. It is incredible, and it does produce what you ask it to do really, really quickly. How does it do it?
There's a YouTuber called Frank White who's posted a video of how he wrote his science fiction novella of about 20,000 words in just 24 hours.
Basically, this is what you want to do if you want to start writing your book. You start giving the ChatGPT information about characters and settings, concepts, and history of the lore that you want your book to revolve around.
He goes on to say that the system will generate a lot of the texts and dialogue, and when you prompt it, it will mesh it all up or gel it all up and generate a comprehensible story. And of course, the better information you give it, the better your book will be. He claims with his knowledge and time, he could write 300 such books within a year, all using the machine. Reuters news agency says as of mid-February, there were more than 200 e-books in Amazon's Kindle store, listing ChatGPT as an author or co-author.
Andrew Cheng reporting. And that's all from us for now. There will be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition of the podcast and the stories we included, the email address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Or you'll find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
This is a perfect storm of conspiracy theories.
On December 15th, 2017, Canadian billionaires Honey and Barry Sherman were found dead in their mansion. To this day, the case remains unsolved.
Counterfeit and copied pharmaceuticals was much more lucrative than heroin, cocaine and the rest of it.
If you live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Listen to the no good, terribly kind, wonderful lives and tragic deaths of Barry and Honey Sherman, wherever you get your podcasts.